This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of EdUp Legal. Today, I am very excited to have as my guest, Christine Riley from the law firm of Manat, Phelps & Phillips. Christine is a partner and she is the leader of the firm's consumer protection practice. So welcome, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the topic we're going to talk about today, I do want to sort of bring up how we got together for this podcast, which is this idea that networking matters and you never know where someone you've seen in a, you know, in a prior life may show up again. And so I think for people listening, you and I had met very briefly years ago. I think we both spoke at, maybe it was LeedsCon or it was, we both spoke at a conference years ago. Yeah, at LeedsCon. And then fast forward to the fall of 2023, and there you are at the Women's General Counsel Network conference, sitting at a table for a cocktail hour that I was facilitating at. So a very small world.
A very small world and really a really great time. That was a fun event.
Wasn't that a wonderful conference? I'm hoping that we'll
really
do it.
Was. I want to do it again this year. So hopefully you guys.
Well, I don't know that we're going to go again this year, but you know, as a member of the advisory council, we're very interested in doing it again. And it was just really great to bring so many fabulous women together. But in any event, you looked familiar to me. I recognized your name. And so here we are now. It took a couple months for us to find a time that worked for both of us. So I'm very excited about this. So today we're going to talk about a topic that I know is of a lot of interest to people in the higher education space. And one that in my sort of 10 years in higher ed, I've spent a lot of time working on in both of the higher ed positions I had. And that's the lead generation marketing space. And we're going to talk a little bit about recent rulemaking by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Before we dive into that, tell us a little bit about your practice and sort of what you work on and why you are the perfect person to be sitting here with me.
Sure, I'm happy to. So I'm Christine Riley out of our Los Angeles office at Manat. I have been leading our consumer protection and advertising group for the last several years. As part of our consumer protection team, we have a dedicated team that works on TCPA issues. And also I would say TSR, telemarketing sales rule, which is the FTC, not the FCC. And as part of that practice, we work on all sorts of compliance issues related to marketing practices. We have a lot of work in the lead generation space, both for buyers of leads as well as sellers of leads. So we have both perspectives to offer. I've been working on TCPA issues since 2010, right before TCPA became this really big area where there were just so many cases filed. I was right at the start of that. And then, you know, who would have known that over, you know, over 10 years later, I would still be doing so much talking about TCPA because it always changes. It keeps changing and growing. And it's always exciting. There's always something new to talk about.
You know, you're bringing back a memory for me. So when I first started in higher ed, it was the summer of 2013. And I believe that the EWC requirement had recently come out and the organization that I was at was trying to figure out, what does the language look like? Should it be a checkbox? Should it be an unchecked box? Should it be a submit button? And I had forgotten how much time we put into sort of like thinking about what did this like heightened scrutiny requirement actually mean? Wow. That goes back.
Yeah, I mean, that was big topic in 2012 and 2013, mm-hmm. just getting used to the new prior express written consent requirements. I remember I had a checkbox, a checklist of all the new requirements that I had pasted on my wall because I kept talking about them. Now it's, you know, it's embedded in my brain. I don't need a listing on the side of my desk, but those were, that was the beginning of really kind of where we are today, and it just keeps changing.
And it's funny because I was first asked to speak on a panel about this in probably 2014. And I think I've spoken once or twice every year about this topic. And while I guess I would say the more things change, the more they remain the same. So I know what we're going to talk about today is really kind of, you know, potentially a huge change in the way sort of lead generators work. So maybe we could dive right in. And what we're going to talk about is recent rulemaking by the FCC. That I guess rulemaking came out in November, shortly before the holidays, with I believe the FCC voting and a decision being made sometime in mid-December. I should have checked the dates before we started recording, but I didn't.
No, it was November 22nd or 23rd, and the final order is December 18th. And by the way, this is par for the course with the FCC. It seems anytime they have something major, it's always around a holiday. Always snuck in right before a holiday. And it's usually, you know, it was Thanksgiving this year, then it was right before Christmas. You may recall back in 2015 when we got that omnibus order, that was right around 4th of July. That came out July 5th. So It all kind of happens usually around holidays. So I'll tell you from a TCPA defense lawyer perspective, I'm always nervous right around holidays. Because I keep thinking, what is going to drop around the holiday that will probably consume my weekend or my holiday?
That's interesting. So do you have any predictions for Memorial Day? I guess that's like the next big holiday that's coming up. I'm guessing that they don't consider Valentine's Day to be one of their holidays.
No, Valentine's Day doesn't qualify. And I think luckily for everyone in the industry, I think May is a little too soon for anyone to make any more major moves.
Okay, so you've set people at ease, so that's great. So now that you've done that, let's sort of dive in. So clearly this most recent rulemaking has a couple different parts of it, and I don't know that we can get to all of them today, but I would like to dive into a little bit about the new rules around, you know, lead gen marketing and consent and what consent looks like. And, you know, clearly the FCC had some different ideas in this rule go around than in previous ones. So maybe give us sort of a high level of what is the new rulemaking focus on?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack in the order, but I think really for this audience, there are really a couple of main things. What everyone is talking about is one-to-one consent. What does it mean to have one-to-one consent, and how do we apply that in the lead generation context? You know, it really is very simple. It really means the FCC wants you to have consent for one seller at a time. So if you want to get consent from multiple parties in a lead gen form, for example, they want the consumer to elect and affirmatively select each seller that they want to hear from. They basically want to give consumers a choice. They no longer can we just do hyperlinks where you'd have a lead form and say, you agree to be contacted by our marketing partners, which would be a hyperlink with hundreds, if not thousands, of parties. That is really what led to this FCC order. It is that practice where I think, unfortunately, there were lots of companies that were doing it, I think, in a very reasonable fashion. But then there were some other companies that really, really pushed the envelope on putting in, you know, 2,000 names. And not only putting in a lot of different names, but putting in parties that aren't even necessarily related to the website in which they were giving consent. You know, we always like to use certain industries are very scrutinized, if you will, solar being one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you go to a solar website, you put in your information, the hyperlink has 2,000 names, and some of those are about car loans or loan consolidations, stuff that has nothing to do with solar.
Which begs the question. I mean, first of all, a problem of their own making, right? So, you know, had this not been done, and I respect your point that it wasn't being done by everybody, but had this not being done, there might not have needed this sort of black and white rule, one consumer, one consent, one company. But also, you have to scratch your head and say, well, is that effective marketing, right? So if I'm looking for whatever I'm looking for solar, and now I've got credit card companies calling me. I mean, are they really going to get that level of business out of that? I don't know. That's the part I sort of always scratch my head at. Like, is it really an effective marketing tool?
I've always kind of wondered that too, right? Because someone who's, you know, for example, looking at solar, are they also interested in a car loan or something else unrelated? I really wonder if those conversion rates are really there. But you know,
I don't think I'm going to answer my phone and then be like, oh yeah, I hadn't really thought about wanting a new car. Sure, I want a new car today.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you know, there's probably some more closely held examples. You know, for example, you sign up for solar and you have a list of home improvement partners. Mm-hmm. Home improvement means a lot of different things. You know, if I'm looking for solar, I'm not necessarily looking for new windows. So, you know, there was certainly many companies that I think were doing this in a very reasonable fashion, but you know, there were lots that weren't, and it was becoming a real problem. And so now we have more of these black and white type of rules in this space, and it is going to cause some real changes in the lead generation space. And by the way, I don't think the sky is falling. I don't think that necessarily this is the end of lead generation. I don't believe in that at all. What I do believe in is that we need to make some changes. It will impact businesses and maybe certain lines of business, but this is something that can be worked through. It can be done. It will just take some change.
And I think for those of us, well, I won't call you a nerd. I'll just call myself a nerd, which I often do on this podcast. I am a nerd. I love
too.
To read. So for those of us that, you know, sort of enjoyed reading the actual order itself, I think to your point, you know, the FCC does say they're not trying to put the industry out of business. And they do recognize that giving consumers valuable information that they want is a noble business. So I think when you combine that with the dissent that was put in by one of the commissioners about, you know, this is just too broad right now, I think to your point, there is this glimmer of hope that if you just maybe to your point, making changes, doing it a different way. But I also agree with you. And I remember when the order first came out, I started seeing posts and blogs that were just, you know, the lead gen industry is finished. And so it's nice to hear someone who practices in that space saying, no, that's not the case. It's just, it's different. And so it's not only one-to-one consent, there's sort of other parameters within that, how you obtain the one-to-one consent. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that. So what else goes into that bucket?
Yeah. And let me just mention one other thing, Deborah. I actually think that with this order, there really comes great opportunity for companies. Because I think with the one-to-one consent, if companies are going to comply, I think that just makes that lead even stronger. And maybe there are opportunities that you charge more for a lead because the lead is going to be a real quality lead. This is someone who has said, I want to be contacted
by this company. Yep.
By this company. And for
That's
companies
a good point.
That are already doing this in some fashion, I do know there are companies that have already been doing a one-to-one type of arrangement. That is a competitive advantage. If you are already doing this and you have it set up that way, there is a pitch to be made that we've already been doing this even before the FCC came out, you know, and here's how effective we've done it. So I already know that this can be done. I've seen clients actually do it and do it very successfully. And what they end up having is better leads, and they make more money from the leads that they have. So I'm really hoping that that becomes a more widespread practice as a result of the order, rather than everyone saying, we can't operate, we can't do this. Yes, we can. And maybe it'll end up being better in the long run.
I love that perspective. And it also plays into my other sort of soapbox thing I love to talk about, which is that it is possible to have good compliance with the law and also drive your business forward. And that every time you hear the word compliance, you don't have to shake your head and say, you know, business killer. And so to hear you say, look, people have done this and you do it right, you comply with the law, that's also a competitive advantage because the people that are your clients probably takes solace. Well, some mostly, hopefully, take solace in the fact that you're, you know, legally compliant in these ways.
I know I get these questions sometimes. Well, you know, what about the fact that we go through a ping tree and we have to figure out, you know, who's going to pay more for the lead? And we want to be able to present that. You know, we want to be able to present the best match possible. And my answer to that is you still can. You know, you could still present the first seller who you think is going to pay more for the lead. You can put the lead presentation in a certain order that makes sense for the business. And there's multiple ways that you can present multiple sellers. You know, you could do it one at a time. You could do it in a list where somebody checks a box. If you think that you have a better lead arrangement with company X, put company X first as the first person that first company that the consumer sees and agrees to. I mean, there are ways to work this new arrangement that I think can actually be very profitable and can really make sense.
So are you getting clients that are reaching out to you to say, sort of brainstorm with me, how do I follow this rule and also keep my business competitive? Because that's kind of fun. That's sort of a hybrid of you're providing legal advice, but you're also getting to be part of sort of that strategic decision-making, which is one of the reasons I love being in-house, because I feel like you get to do that all the time.
And that's one of the reasons why I love being a lawyer, because I actually really enjoy being like a business partner, mm-hmm. really sitting at the table and thinking creatively about what is it that we can do to make the business profitable. I'm not looking to kill the business or kill profitability. I'm looking at ways, how do we protect the company but still make them profitable and still realize the goals? And this type of conversation with clients is really fun. And you get to sit down and look at mock-ups, you get to make adjustments, you know, offer different perspectives. Our clients come up with great ideas. What do you think about this mock-up, this presentation? It's really actually a lot of fun. And that's one of the great things about working in this space is just having that creativity and thinking like a business person and not just like a lawyer.
Well, as a seasoned general counsel, I can tell you that, you know, those are the people that rise on my radar screen, because I think when you're trained, you know, as a young lawyer, I mean, I spent many years at a big law firm, you're trained, and I was a litigator, you're trained to do the practice of law that your clients are hiring you for. You're not necessarily trained as a litigator to think about, well, what is my client's end game? How do I get out of this litigation? Or what if my client is litigating with like a business partner? How do you solve the dispute and preserve the relationship? So I think, like, you know, the sooner you can learn how to support the business in what you do, the more invaluable you become to your clients.
And let me throw something else at you. So I get all sorts of questions and they're all very interesting. We have clients that call us and say, what can we do to comply? How does this mock-up look? Would this work? Does this not work? But then I also have, you know, a bucket of clients that say, I do not want to comply with these new rules. What about if I just don't make automated calls? If I just don't do pre-recorded voice messages, I don't use artificial voices, and of course I don't use an auto dial, I'm okay, right? I could just keep doing what I'm doing and I can keep reselling leads. I just need to make sure I'm not using this technology that triggers this new one-to-one consent rule. So I get a lot of those questions too.
So let's talk about that. Let's answer that question, because I think that question also comes up in the TCPA rubric, right? Well, none of that applies to me as long as I am not using, and I think, you know, it would be safe to say nobody's really sure what an auto dialer is in today's, you know, world. How do you advise clients when they ask that question?
So what I think it's a risky proposition to simply say we won't use that type of automated technology. And let's kind of unpack it a bit. Pre-recorded voice messages, artificial voices are very risky. In terms of the suits that we see on a daily basis, most of our cases are pre-recorded voice messages, do not call violations, or internal do not call violations. And it's really hard to argue that a pre-recorded voice message is not a pre-recorded message. It either is or it's not. And even if there isn't one, there's all this litigation just trying to figure out if a pre-record was actually sent. So that's one of
the if a pre-recorded message actually what?
Was sent.
Was sent, okay.
For example, we have a case right now where we're arguing over the last 7-8 months about whether our client sent a pre-recorded voice message. Our client did not, does not even use pre-recorded voice messages, yet here we are in a class action lawsuit having to defend against an allegation that this person received a single pre-recorded voice message. So even if you're not using
And is that, I don't want to go down sort of because my hashtag is making legal easy where you can't speak any legalese. So is that because of the way litigation is structured, you have to be at some sort of, you know, sort of summary judgment phase after fact gathering, and because it makes it very difficult to get out of litigation early if you just tell the truth, if you just present the truth? Is that sort of what's going on there?
So a lot of times you can present the truth and you can call up the opposing side and have standing conversation and say, listen, you don't have a case because there is no message. It didn't happen. And most of the time, you can get out of a case. You can either get it resolved with a settlement or someone can be convinced to walk away. But then you get into these situations where counsel and the plaintiff.
Nothing to lose.
Up and down. Nope. I swear your client sent a pre-recorded message. I know you did. And now we have to go through discovery to find out, really, was there a pre-recorded message? And it could end up in summary judgment, but it's their burden to prove it at the end of the day. And the reason why this is all important is because if you are using the technology that triggers these rules, or potentially using the technology that triggers the rules, the next issue in the case is going to be whether you have consent. So it is risky to not comply and not have a consent defense, because then you're arguing about your not your sole defense, but your main defense is going to be, I didn't use the pre-recorded message. I didn't use the auto dialer. You won't have, oh, but we complied. If we complied and there is consent, those are golden.
Right. And those other questions are irrelevant because no matter how you resolve those, doesn't matter to the case as long as I have your consent and I can prove it.
Right. Because that becomes a much more unattractive case for the plaintiff's lawyer, who says, oh, not only do I have to deal with whether there was automated technology used, but now I have a consent issue I have to deal with. The case just becomes more complicated. So I think at the end of the day, these are business decisions that have to be made. But I would say not complying with these rules has a lot of inherent risk. You have to be prepared for those risks if you're not going to get consent. The auto dialer issue, which we could probably spend an hour talking about auto dialers, we're still not totally sure what an auto dialer is. Now there's a new bill that just got introduced that would change the auto dialer definition to basically change what Facebook came out with. You know, Congress doesn't like the narrow interpretation from Facebook, from the Supreme Court. Now they're thinking about legislation that'll make it much broader. Who knows where that will go? But, you know, I worry about that too, that it's not clear what an auto dialer is. Courts are confused. They don't understand.
They don't understand. Right.
They don't understand it.
Yes.
And the plaintiff lawyers are quite successful at confusing them. So it's a mixed bag. Are you using an auto dialer? Maybe, maybe not.
And that's very interesting because I think enough time has passed since the Facebook decision such that people have decided there are certain forms of technology that are outside of an auto dialer, whatever an auto dialer is, maybe click to dial or something like that. And so they've relied on this technology for several years. So now if there's a new bill or if there's a new law that comes out, suddenly what you've been relying on for these years may not, you know, may not fit into that category of probably not an auto dialer. I'm probably like safe.
That's right. Let me put another spin on it. I wonder whether these new consent rules, because they are so favorable for consumers, they create this enormous opportunity for plaintiff lawyers to push the envelope. right? Do you have one-to-one consent? Show us your one-to-one consent. I wonder if some of the plaintiff lawyers will say, you know what? Maybe it's time to push the auto dialer cases that again, we haven't been bringing as much. And it's true. I'm not seeing that many auto dialer cases right now. And that is very, very good news. But I see these new rules and I say to myself, I don't know, maybe the plaintiff lawyers will start really pushing the envelope because consent may be harder to obtain. And they realize that some companies are probably not going to get this consent. So who knows? Maybe there's a resurrection of auto dialer claims that we haven't been seeing since Facebook.
This is interesting because along with a colleague of mine, a partner at an outside law firm, we've written a monthly column called Inside Out, and we take, you know, different topics and give a summary of the topic. And then he writes the outside counsel version and I write the in-house guidance. And we try to give people sort of two different perspectives on the same issue, which I've affectionately called it our Inside Out column. And we did a column on these rules when they first came out. And his conclusion about from the outside counsel advice were the exact same things that you're saying now several months later, which is consent is key. This is a very great opportunity for the plaintiff's bar. So that's interesting, sort of, you know, and for our listeners, we didn't talk about this beforehand. So this is really just organic, but that's interesting. And to your point, we could spend all day talking about this, but it's sort of in the interest in kind of moving the conversation along, before we hit record, we were talking a little bit about some of the questions that you're getting and some of the issues that people are raising with you. And one of them I wanted to be sure to get to because I think it's really fascinating. You were mentioning that you have you've been having conversations with some of your lead gen clients who are thinking about how can, you know, we think of lead generators as getting consent on a seller, on a seller's behalf, right? Or buyer's behalf. But what can the lead generators do on their own behalf? And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that because I didn't get your opinion on this issue. So I was going to save it for the recording, but it's really an interesting question. So maybe you could set the question up, the issue up, and then sort of talk us through it.
Yes. So I think this is a pretty juicy area. And there's probably going to be a wide range of opinions. I think you'll probably talk to different folks in the space and they all might have different answers. But here's the issue. This order says that you need to get consent one seller at a time. A lot of lead generators, as part of their business, like to make the calls themselves. And they want to get consent for their company to call. For example, let's say you're a lead generator in the education space. You might want to get consent directly from the consumer so that your inquiry generation business, your call center, can call those consumers, go through a line of questions, and then at the end of those questions, figure out who you want to match that consumer to. Maybe it ends up being there's three universities or schools, maybe it's two, but you want the opportunity to engage with the consumer live, go through the questions with them, and then you want to match. And the question is, can you still do that under these new rules? Well, I can probably make a pitch on things in this FCC order that say maybe you can't do that. And then there are other things in the order where I would argue, yes, you can. I think if we take it from a conceptual point of view, what is wrong with the idea of a lead generator saying, I want consent to call you, even telling them I'm going to match you. We're going to talk about educational opportunities. And then once you get them on the call, giving them specific consent for specific schools. And say, do I have your permission? Does this university have permission to call you using automated technology, blah, 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 the whole disclosure? What is offensive about that arrangement? That's kind of where I start from. My own opinion is I don't think that the FCC order prohibits that. I think that the FCC order is saying that they do not want these consent farms where there is like these unlimited number of calls and parties calling because leads are sold and resold and you haven't given consent for all of these entities. But what is wrong with getting consent from the lead generator That's one consent right there. And then matching them and asking for the consents specifically for the school.
And I think you're also talking. Yeah, and you're also talking about, we didn't sort of talk about this specifically, but in the example that you're giving here, what the lead vendor is calling about is topically and related to each other, because they're, in this example, they're calling to only talk to you about education. They're not getting consent to call you, and then they're, I'm going to talk to you about education. Now I'm going to move on to credit cards. I'm going to talk about mortgages, and then we'll hit solar on the end before we disconnect.
Right. And that's why I say, what is offensive about that type of arrangement? Does the FCC order say that the only way you can match consumers is by an online lead form? I would say no. You don't have to just do matching by website.
I'm just excited. Sorry, I'm interrupting you. I hear that. I was going to say, you said at the beginning, you could point to things in the order that would say yes and would say no. So what's the devil's advocate to that? What's the flip side of that argument?
That it's not covered?
Correct.
There are certain provisions in the FCC order that talk about, you can do, you know, comparison website shopping can be done. You know, it could be done in other ways. It could be done email, mail. And I think it gave a bunch of examples. But one thing that was clear is it didn't give the example of telephone call. And it didn't talk about matching. It kind of talked about all other things aside from getting the lead to be consent for the lead generator. And that language we pointed to and said, well, I don't know, either they didn't think about it, or they were thinking that it wouldn't be acceptable under the order. It's not entirely clear, but I think this is probably an issue that will be litigated, right? Mm-hmm. I think there will be lead generators that will get one-to-one consent for themselves. And there will definitely be plaintiff lawyers that will argue that that is totally improper under the FCC order. And I think it'll make for a very interesting to a first impression for any court interpreting this new FCC order. I think the balance of the arguments weighs in favor of allowing this, because if a consumer says, I know you're going to call me to match and I give you my consent, and yes, I've been matched, and I give consent for these schools, what is the issue? They've given
consent. Because you're clear and conspicuous, you're transparent, and then you carry through when you call on the alleged promise that you made when you got their consent. So I hear what you're saying. Well, this will be an interesting issue to follow. In the last couple minutes that we have left, let's talk about one other specific example, which is, a lot of education leads come from job boards, right? And so is jobs and education, are they logically and topically related? Can you still obtain consent through potentially a job lead? And I know this is something, you know, years ago, the issue was, not for one-to-one consent, but generally the issue was, yes, if you ask that particular question, can I talk to you about education? Or do you also want information about education? Yes. Okay. No, I don't present that. So I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about that sort of relationship following this order.
Yeah, this is also a pretty interesting topic. You know, I think arguments could be made both ways. And I think
that's why we're lawyers, right?
Yes, absolutely. We could argue both ways. And, you know, our education clients would say, well, of course, educational opportunities are related to jobs. Maybe I'm looking for a job, but I'm also looking to maybe further my education and be better suited for a job later on, or just to get better skills. I think they are related, but I do think that issue is risky. The FTC, I think, has made very clear that they do not think that looking for jobs is the same thing as looking for educational opportunities. In fact, we didn't talk about this either, Deborah, but just a couple of days ago, the FTC came out with a stipulated order against EDU Trek, where they're banned from telemarketing. And that was also a result of job boards, people looking for jobs, but were sold educational opportunities. So for sure, the FTC doesn't agree. I would think probably the FCC doesn't either. What courts will do in private class action litigation is a more interesting question. Do they think it's logically and topically associated? Where I can get comfortable is kind of what you said earlier, which is if your website is about jobs and it's not about jobs and educational opportunities, the way to do that, if you're going to do it, is to have a separate interaction that says, are you interested in educational opportunities? And that consumer either says yes or no. If they say yes, you can give them a TCPA disclosure and get that one-to-one consent. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it that way, although I'm sure my counterparts on the plaintiff's bar will absolutely disagree with you. They will say, and they will point to all the language in the order that talks about logically and topically associated with the website. But you know what? That's actually not what the regulations say. If you look at the regulations, the actual wording of the regulation that just went in, is going into effect, it says logically and topically associated with the interaction that prompted the consent. That's not the same thing as the website. I would say the interaction that prompted the consent is asking someone, are you interested?
That's the interaction. I know my role here is to facilitate our conversation, but because I can, because it's my podcast, I will say, I agree with you. I agree with you, but I do think asking that question is important. And having been on the EDU side, from the institution's perspective, it's frustrating for admissions teams when they are contacting people where the lead came from a job board and the person doesn't want to be contacted about education. You know, admissions counselors don't want to call people that don't want to talk to them. I mean, that's right. And to say otherwise, I just don't understand that. I mean, you know, that is not the job you want, to call a bunch of people that really have no interest in talking to you, number one, and number two, are not interested in education. So going back to your comment before about a valuable lead and a lead that is likely to, you know, convert, those are not valuable leads and they are not likely to result in new students.
I think that's absolutely right. And I've heard the same thing from our EDU clients, that they want real leads. The universities and the schools, they want people who are really interested in education. Otherwise, they're expending resources, call center time, to call folks who just hang up or say, why are you calling me?
So, and I also think if you started talking to people on the student success side and sort of the academic side, you would find that even if those leads were to convert and someone were to be able to convince somebody they may want to get a degree or they may want to go back to school, those are not the people who are going to persist. So those are the people who are going to leave school, and your retention rate is, you know, you're not going to retain those students. So then you're making the job more difficult for the people they interact with once they get to school, if they didn't really want to be there in the first place. So
that's right.
Yeah.
So I don't see anything wrong with, I mean, I know this will be litigated, so there's a risk, right? But I will say this, I would take that case any day, and I would argue the heck out of it to say that there's nothing wrong with that. What is wrong with asking somebody if they're interested in educational opportunities? And if they say no, we move on. You're talking about jobs. But if they say yes, that's a good consumer experience too. Maybe they are interested. And if they say yes, why should you not be able to get consent to call them to have that conversation? That to me is anti-consumer.
And that to me goes right to the heart of the only one positive statement that I think is in the order about all of this, which is that comparison shopping done right is a good thing, and it does provide a valuable service to the consumer. So I think, and I agree with you, that seems to be an example of a good interaction and a good consumer experience.
Or even better, isn't this whole order about consumer choice? They keep talking about consumers need to have a choice. Okay, I can accept that. As a consumer myself, I like to have a choice. Why not give them a choice to ask them if they're interested in education? And if they are, great. That's a great consumer experience. So to me, it's consistent with the theme of the order, which is giving consumers choices and allowing them to make decisions on who they want to hear from and what they want to hear from them on.
Well, I think that is a fabulous place to stop, even though I would love to keep talking to you. So hopefully I can invite you to come back on another episode. We can continue this conversation. But, you know, I, as a, like, as I said before, as an in-house lawyer and a general counsel, I absolutely appreciate your practicality and, you know, the mindset of getting to yes with explaining, you know, here, this may be a risk or this may not, or, but I love that. And I think, you know, more outside counsel should sort of adopt that approach. And so anyone listening who's in this space and has any questions, you know, Christine, she's got some practical suggestions and answers. So I encourage you all to reach out to her and thank you for joining me. It's been a great afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much, Deborah. This was so much fun. So let's definitely do it again.
Thanks.